And I think understanding the ways that campaigns think about tactics and use tactics is important to understand the sort of stories that politicians tell themselves about how they got where they are. And I wrote a piece recently about Beto O'Rourke's Senate campaign, and that was a place where the strategy was very much informed by the tactics. And if you didn't really understand how they thought about the tactics, you would not be able to intelligently interrogate the strategic questions.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. In this episode, I talked to Sasha Eisenberg about his career in journalism, which includes his authorship of the book Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, and a series of articles that continue to today and concentrate on the use of data, analytics, and software in organizing and political campaigns. Those writings have established Sasha as expert on that aspect of politics. So we discussed his very recent article on the organizing tactics of the Beto campaign and how they informed the strategy in that race. I also learned in the interview that Sasha got his start with the political magazine George, working with John Kennedy Jr. We also talked about his foray into political entrepreneurship with his own startup a few years ago. And Sasha is just finishing up 7 years of work on the social movement for gay marriage, a book tentatively called Engagement, which promises to be an important read. It was a good conversation about these and many other subjects, well worth your listen. So after a quick word from our sponsor, my interview with Sasha Eisenberg.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Sasha.
Hi, Nathaniel. How are you?
I'm good. Would you mind introducing yourself, giving me a quick biography?
Sure. My name is Sasha Eisenberg. I'm a journalist. I've been a newspaper reporter, magazine writer, and editor. I've spent, the better part of the last 12, 13 years writing books. I wrote a book called The Sushi Economy about the global sushi business. I wrote a book called The Victory Lab about the sort of mechanics and innovation in political campaigns, which is how we first met. And I wrote a book about medical tourism called Outpatients. It came out a couple of years ago, and I'm now working on another, and I still write for a variety of magazines.
It's a pretty serious career as a writer, from what I can see. How did you first move into the field of journalism?
I was lucky enough to get an internship in a magazine called George, which was a political magazine that launched in the mid-90s while I was in high school, just as the magazine was starting up. And I had been interested in politics from a young age, and starting at the age of 12, I volunteered on campaigns over a few years. And I guess in the innocence of those days, I think I wanted to go work in politics in some form or another. And I'd always enjoyed consuming the news, hadn't really had aspirations to go into media, but I found myself in a magazine office for a summer, and I loved the collaborative, creative way that magazine editors sit around and think about how you take something in the news and build a story around it. And there's a sort of sense of ambition and perfectionism in magazine offices that's a lot of fun to be a part. And I guess I quickly came to the conclusion that I was still as interested in ever in politics and other things, but that I was more interested in being around them as an observer than I was as a participant.
And George was that John Kennedy Jr. politics sort of entertainment nexus magazine, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the term that they used was sort of the intersection of politics and popular culture. So in 1995, when it launched, I think there was a certain novelty to just the sort of observation that what had been sort of separate spheres in American life, the world of politics and government, the world of popular culture, had been treated as distinct with a sort of separate cast of characters, separate media organizations, media outlets covering them, that they had become fused. So, you know, you think about stuff like Bill Clinton going on Arsenio Hall or Charles Barkley talking about how he was going to run for governor of Alabama, that there was this sort of overlap of these worlds. And the sort of animating conceits of George was both to cover that intersection, the places where popular culture was touching on political themes or celebrities are getting involved in politics or politicians were engaging with things outside what we would think of as a traditional milieu of government, but also to document political figures, not as celebrities, but with a lot of the same tools. So both to approach certain types of magazine forms and features the way that feature magazines might, when dealing with a movie star, use some of the same sort of visual language. And a lot of this sounds incredibly banal now and familiar. And I think that's because a lot of media and our culture has sort of moved inexorably to the understanding that it's really hard to separate these things. But if you look at the coverage of somebody like, let's say, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it's really hard to separate where the interest in her is coming from a traditional political media with policy and political curiosities and where it's coming from a sort of interest in her as a personality that's far more informed by the sort of language of cultural coverage.
Did you have a chance to interact with Kennedy during that summer?
Yeah, it was so I ended up staying there for the whole life of the magazine in some form or another, which was 5.5 years. Bizarrely, I was the only person who was with the magazine for its whole life. I sort of interned for, I think, 6 summers while I was in school and started doing some writing and research for the magazine while during the school years, now through college, and interacted with John a lot. It was one of the great things, and one of the disadvantages of being in a startup is that things are short-staffed, and the magazine, relative to some of the folks that we thought we competed with, had surprisingly few editors. And so there wasn't a lot of a buffer between anybody and John. And I, you know, one of the things I got to do pretty quickly was he would do a monthly long Q&A with the news figure or historical subject, somebody in the magazine. And he was getting major figures just by dint of who he was. And so I ended up researching those for him within weeks of showing up the magazine. As a high school student on a summer vacation, I was helping him prepare questions to ask George Wallace for an interview he was going down to do in Alabama. So, you know, it was a pretty familiar environment. And particularly through those interviews, it gave me a chance to get my hands dirty in a way that most internships, I guess, typically don't.
Did you come to a theory about what kind of questions work well with someone in politics?
Not then. And this probably reflects more recent insight for me, certainly among politicians, folks who are well drilled at answering questions. So, you know, candidates, office holders, sometimes staffers if they have a very high profile. I think you just want to find ways to get people to think out loud, either frame a choice that they have not had to think of as a choice before, get them weighing trade-offs or options that they hadn't thought of as trade-offs or options. I have found that if you do that, you can push somebody outside of their normal lanes of funneling questions into, here's how I talk about housing, here's how I talk about fundraising, here's how I talk about my party, whatever it may be, and force them to sort of cross those boundaries in ways that make them think aloud. And when they think aloud, then you're getting, I think, a more organic sense of not just what they value, but how they use language when they're not reciting something. I think that's the key for interviewing politicians. And if you're trying to get insight into their minds, I mean, obviously there's huge value in folks who do the traditional Tim Russert, let me just ask you a simple factual question 5 times to get you on the record on some point. And I think we've seen with Trump that there's some great civic and public value to journalists who just try to isolate his opinion on a certain thing just so that there's a record of it.
Did you think that Kennedy was good at what he did? Did you learn from him?
Yeah. I mean, what most impressed me about him was he had come to be a magazine editor with no experience in journalism. I don't think it was a secret that if he weren't John Kennedy, he would not have been in any position to launch a magazine, and certainly not one with the stature and resources that George had from its first day. In certain respects, he was a dilettante. I don't think he would have denied that. What most impressed me was that we would be in these meetings with John and 6, 8, 10, 12 editors of various levels at the magazine, all of whom had some journalism pedigree. He would regularly just have really sharp observations about stories and framing of them that came from some combination of being well-read and curious and developing good instincts, presumably as a reader and as somebody who was, you know, slowly being exposed to magazine decision-making. And regularly, he would impress me by having the sort of sharpest read at how you go about a given topic or what a headlining or approach to packaging a given story ought to be. And that just instilled in me at a relatively young age was that if I wanted to be a journalist, going to journalism school, a lot of the traditional like dues-paying ideas in journalism, whether that's going to journalism school or going to cover night cops for 2 years at some small newspaper or, you know, all these sort of things that at least in the pre-digital age seem like sort of necessary ladder climbing steps weren't necessarily the case. Like the skill set that one needed to be a good journalist was to be smart and curious and that some instincts were necessary and to be comfortable with words, both reading and writing them, and that the instincts and skill sets can be developed in spheres other than paying one's dues in journalism. And so I never gave a thought to going to journalism school or taking journalism classes in college or doing any of that stuff. And that was, I think, instilled in me by exposure to John during those years.
I'm curious more about this George experience. I didn't know you had gotten your start that way. What else did you take from your time there?
I've given a lot of thought to why the magazine succeeded and failed. I'm not sure any of this has sort of shaped what I've done, but it has sort of refined my sense of what it takes to create a media organization that's doing high-quality coverage of politics. And the big challenge is that a lot of advertisers, I think the central sort of problem that the magazine had, and put aside, I mean, I think that they're quite reasonable editorial critiques of the magazine, but there was a fundamental business problem apart from them. And it was that if you're trying to create a general interest magazine about politics, and you know, the magazine got up to, I think, 425,000 paid subscribers every month. So we're talking about a decent sized circulation, certainly far higher than the New Republic or The Nation or the Weekly Standard or what people thought of as political magazines in 1995, National Review, many multiples of their circulation. You know, the problem was that from a business perspective, the magazines that George thought of as competitors or peers, you know, were Vanity Fair or GQ or Men's Journal or The Times Magazine or The New Yorker, folks that George was competing with for writers, that competing with for readers, advertisers, stories. Compared to some of those general interest magazines, I think that that some advertisers saw politics as high risk or toxic. And given consumer advertiser who is in fashion or travel or automotive or tech, I think was really afraid of the idea that you would be in a magazine up against some story about some controversial politician or some issue or whatever it may be, and that from a sort of brand's perspective was incredibly risky. And then the other problem, which really became clear with the economic downturn after the NASDAQ crash in 99, was that even among those advertisers in those consumer sectors, George could never be that essential. And all of these advertisers had a kind of magazines that were closer to like their endemic ad base. And so what we saw at the magazine was that a lot of advertisers that had been happy to put George on their advertising schedules in 96, 97, 98, when business was good, when they had to retrench as the economy turned a couple of years later and they started cutting back, well, Dell or Hewlett Packard wasn't going to cut back from Wired, and British Airways or Hyatt wasn't going to cut back from Condé Nast Traveler, and Versace wasn't going to cut back from Vogue, but they all could cut back from George because George didn't really feel like it got to their core audience. And when you cut back, you're left with the types of advertisers who were in the New Republic and National Review, which are just not big name advertisers who are paying a lot to be in a glossy magazine. And that was kind of the, you know, central business problem for the magazine. And that experience is something I bring as I look at the media landscape now. I mean, you look at a publication like Politico, which has done quite well, and that's because they figured out that their core audience is decision makers in Washington, and that the people who want to advertise them are people with government business. But it also means that you're, you know, building your media organization on the back of ads from Northrop Grumman or whoever else is looking for the attention of decision makers in Washington. And it's very hard to create a kind of mass market publication that has lots of resources to approach sort of ambitiously reported, richly told, artistically presented stories about, you know, politics and government. And so there are good stories every month that are in about political topics that are in The New Yorker, that are in The Atlantic, that are in GQ, that are in Rolling Stone, that are in The Times Magazine. But the reason that none of those things are all in the same magazine, I think, is because of this kind of advertiser problem.
And when you're describing the characteristics of the kind of story that's hard to find in one magazine, I think you're talking partially about the kind of things that you want to write and that you do write. You worked as a columnist at least in 2008, 12, and 16. That's as much as I know, for The Globe, for Slate, for Bloomberg, covering the campaigns. What is it like to do that job? And how do you evaluate the way the press covers these campaigns these days?
In 2008, so I was at the Boston Globe. I was based in their Washington bureau as a national political correspondent. I had never written for a newspaper before. And so I'd been a magazine writer at Philadelphia Magazine. The Globe took Marty Baron, who's now the editor of the Washington Post, was the editor who hired me at the Globe. And he and Peter Canellos, who was the bureau chief, took a big bet on hiring somebody who would, like, I literally never covered a fire or a zoning board meeting or high school hockey game or any of the things where you show up and you have to make sense of an event in 90 minutes and put it to paper. I had some experience writing features as a magazine writer, profiles of political figures, stories about campaigns, projects right within weeks, if not months, writing a long magazine story. And so what they were hiring me for was a combination of, I think they wanted more featurey, enterprisey stories. I was set out covering the presidential campaign in 2008, and a lot of what I did was that, but also certainly had to cover my share of news. I spent the fall and winter covering a lot of John McCain. When I joined the Globe in September of 07, they had 8 reporters assigned to candidates in the, so you had open Democratic and Republican primaries. You had reporters on Clinton, Edwards, and Obama on the Democratic side, and 5 Republicans. And McCain was seen to be the one with the lowest likelihood in September of 07 of winning the nomination. And I was the most junior person on the team. And so I got put on McCain. And it turned out to be a great reporting experience, in part because there were so few people covering him at that point. And when combined with what was then McCain's great openness towards the media, means I got a lot of access to him, and there wasn't a whole lot of other campaign infrastructure that was getting in my way. And so I wrote a pretty wild mix of stories over the course of that year. I wrote a few big biographical pieces about McCain, picked out periods in his life that I didn't feel had been well understood or well picked over, and tried to dig into those as a lens into bigger themes in his political career. I did the same on a couple of Obama stories as well. I wrote some sort of oddball features. I remember sort of noticing as I traveled around cities over the course of the summer of 2008, as Obama got the nomination, I was seeing all sorts of merchandise being sold in by street vendors that folks who normally would be selling bootleg sports merchandise or stuff with celebrities on it. That there's this whole sort of Obama cargo cult, especially in street vendors in big cities selling merchandise. And so I wrote a piece for 52nd Street in West Philadelphia about the sort of boom in Obama, unofficial Obama merchandise. So, you know, I was trying to find different ways to write about how all different parts of the campaign, the candidates, stuff like that, about that sort of got to how voters were interacting with their candidacies. But I think the bulk of what the sort of implied mandate for most good stories about elections are is, can you be first to identify some big thing on which this election will turn? And can you write a piece that identifies, you know, what the big issue is going to be, or what the key state is going to be, or what demographic group is going to matter most, or what the most important strategic calculation will be, or the technological innovation or tactic? The earlier you can do that, the better. And so I think that, you know, we see this today, like, as people start writing about the Democratic nominating process, already there's some desire to, I think the sort of newspaper pieces that stand out, at least at the moment, are ones where you think somebody's a little farsighted at picking up what this thing's going to revolve around. And probably most of the pieces I wrote that year tried to do that in some form or another. And it was only after that election that I fell into the world of folks who were dealing with data, analytics, experiments, micro-targeting. And what I sort of came to realize is that this idea that elections are about, like, big things was to some extent a fiction or mythology that journalists imposed on it, and that there were lots of people inside of campaigns who at the time were ascendant, who were focused on really small things, that there was a story about innovation in that world. And so I ended up writing this book, The Victory Lab, and then the coverage I did in 2012 and 2016 for Slate in 2012, and then for Bloomberg Politics and Business Week in 2016, was largely informed by, you know, a far narrower set of curiosities about the sort of mechanics of campaigns, particularly focused on voter contact and innovations in the world of campaigning generally. And so since my time at the Globe, I think I've had a sort of far more narrowly tailored idea of what I can do that is distinctive, and don't spend a lot of time going to candidate events anymore or trying to write stuff that is more likely to bump me up against, you know, 14 other reporters who are working on the same thing that day.
You've traipsed into the world that I've been in a long time in politics and technology by doing that. I've always thought that those things, all of the analytics, the data, the way that campaigns mobilize, most of that tends to matter on the margin, particularly in a general. What's your kind of mature view now about the importance of the tactical, I guess, if that's what you might call that, versus the strategic, the big messages, the positions that candidates take and their skills in communicating and things like that?
All evidence we have points to the idea that these are marginal improvements, right? So, you know, on one hand, finding efficiencies through better tactics, we don't really have a good handle empirically on what the impact of a good campaign kickoff speech is, or what a good debate performance does, or what a certain type of policy rollout does, just because there are not that many of them in history, and it's very hard to isolate the impact of them. We do now have a huge body of evidence on what the discrete impact of a single knock on a door is at a given point in a campaign with a certain type of impact. And so what we know, I think, from this body of evidence is that you could create votes through better tactics. And yes, those effects are small. Now, we've been in a series of election cycles recently that have been, I guess you'd say, decided at the margins. I think it's perfectly reasonable to throw up your hands and say, oh, all this stuff maybe is good for 2 to 3 points. And then the other thing is, you know, if data and analytics make your campaign 10 or 20% more efficient for certain types of contact, and you're spending $1 billion in a presidential campaign and you're spending 50 million of that on certain types of voter contact, that's real money. So I've always tried to avoid suggesting that any individual tactical choice is the type of thing in which that'll control the outcome of an election by itself. I think that's a ridiculous way to look at things. But I think we should appreciate that a few points or increased efficiency, given the scale of campaigns we're talking about, can matter. The other thing I would say is that it is important to understand the tactics that campaigns use even if they are not determinative of an outcome by themselves. This is a place where political scientists often get so caught up with do campaigns matter literature, and it's no, this thing on its own wasn't determinative of the outcome, thus it didn't matter. The stories that candidates or that politicians once in office tell themselves about how they got elected is really important. And if you think you got elected because you mobilized your base through GOTV tactics, you're going to govern very differently than if you think you won because the campaign you ran successfully won over independents. So, and I think understanding the ways that campaigns think about tactics and use tactics is important to understand the sort of stories that politicians tell themselves about how they got where they are. And I wrote a piece recently about Beto O'Rourke's Senate campaign, and that was a place where the strategy was very much informed by the tactics. And if you didn't really understand how they thought about the tactics, you would not be able to intelligently interrogate the strategic questions.
So let me take you backwards just a little bit, because before you wrote the Beto story, you had written a story, I think, called Barnstorming, about Exley and Bond and big organizing for Sanders. And that is one of the precursors. I think it goes back to Dean and well before that. But the kind of organizing that they're preaching, which is distributed, technology-based, a lot of learnings coming out of Obama and Dean and other races. Talk a little bit about the Barnstorming article and what you saw there, and then how that led into what was happening with Beto.
Yes, this was a piece that I wrote in the winter of 2016 for Bloomberg Politics. I spent about a week around Becky Bond and Zach Exley when they were working on Bernie Sanders' campaign. So around, I remember it was around the Nevada caucuses, because I spent like 11 nights straight in a hotel on the Vegas Strip, keeping what I thought were productive writing hours, which do not accord with the hours that everybody else in the building is keeping. I mean, so a lot of it in 2016 was constrained by the particular challenges that Bernie Sanders faced, right? I mean, I think every presidential primary candidate has a central problem, which is, first of all, you don't really know how long the campaign's going to go. You don't really know in which states you're going to end up competing. You know, you can be pretty certain that you're going to run a campaign in Iowa and New Hampshire. You need to know, you know what you need to do there. You can be pretty certain if you do okay that you will need to, you know, build out a campaign in South Carolina and Nevada. And after that, depending on the calendar, it's really open-ended. And so campaigns often are making really late, impulsive decisions about what to do in the other 46 states and 7 territories and that have delegates. And so the sort of wise, sophisticated approach to field wouldn't work for Sanders. He didn't know how long he'd go on, and he didn't know how much money he would spend, and he didn't know how he would weigh the relative strategic value of given states to his delegate collection tactics months in advance. And so, you know, you look at what was sort of thought of as, I think, the reference standard for how to run a good field program, the Obama reelect in 2012, they were putting field offices in states a full year before Election Day in November. And, you know, with those field offices came organizers who were in their communities for a year. And on top of it, this pretty rigid hierarchy of field organizers, regional field directors, managers. And, you know, this was the kind of creation of a professionalized field structure that I think Obama had very much valorized within the party. Certainly didn't pioneer by any means, but invested in and took seriously, and then he valorized, I think, partially because of his experience as a community organizer. And it was all based on the idea that you needed these sort of locally grounded, long, ongoing interactions with people to get them to, you know, rise up the ladder of engagement, so they could take more and more responsibilities.
And that's probably more what the Clinton operation was doing.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, in 2016, if you looked at any statewide candidate or congressional candidate, they all probably, with the field program, they all probably aspired to that. And the only limits on it were money and time. And then ultimately, the goal is that you create the structure and that it cultivates and develops a volunteer force with these very specific localized duties.
But what happened with Sanders is they found an excess of volunteers to work with.
Yes, and had not had any of that sort of groundwork in place to house and train and the volunteers. And so what they decided they needed to do was figure out a way to kind of have a big net that would catch volunteers wherever they were at the moment that they were enthusiastic about Bernie, and figure out how to not just put them to work quickly, but give them leadership responsibilities, management responsibilities. And they thought that they could break out of the very plodding curve, growth curve, where one field organizer recruits a volunteer at a time. They didn't feel they had the time for that type of one-on-one thing. And so that they did these barnstorm tours in the non-early states where the Sanders campaign wasn't spending official resources, where Zach Exley, for example, would go to Tulsa, Oklahoma, and they'd get a union hall or a some sort of public space, and they would send an email out to everybody on the Bernie list, and they'd say, come to this event. And it may have been the first Bernie event that you'd had in your city. So they actually got amazing turnout from people who are enthusiastic for Bernie. And they weren't there to see Bernie. They were here to see this guy, Zach Exley, who explained to them how this campaign would work and that they could do everything they needed to do from their homes or wherever they were. And within minutes of him laying out how this campaign worked, he was already asking people to host phone banks in their home or lead block walks. And under the old model, you know, under the Obama model, the Hillary model, the governing model, to get to a place where the campaign was making you a block walk captain, you had to have put in months and been trained and groomed and had a field organizer on top of you. And there were basically no staffers mediating this experience. And it allowed them to take in people really quickly. And they used tools that were very primitive at the time of the first Obama campaign that allowed people to, you know, make phone calls from their home computers and that allow them to use apps to canvas. And you never needed to go into a field office and you never needed to have a staffer oversee you. And the campaign decided while they were doing that, it was stupid to have people tethered to the geographies in which they lived. And so if we created this army of people who are making phone calls or sending text messages from their home, why keep them just texting people who are also in Oklahoma or making phone calls to people who are in their area code? Why don't we redirect them wherever in the country we have the need? And so the idea was you sort of find a way to create a really quick supply of volunteer capacity, and then you're able to sort of reroute it to wherever the tactical demand is.
Clearly, that is sort of the beginning of what Beto campaign tries to do. What did you see as happening differently on that campaign and why?
So I think some of the tools simply changed. And I didn't delve too deeply in my story into the technology, but you know, stuff like the way that the laws regulating automated phone calls work and texting, if somebody physically has to press a button that places a phone call or a text message. So calling or texting voters at scale needs to be have some sort of manual intervention. In 2015, the sort of technology solutions that existed for this were, like, as best I could tell, fairly jerry-rigged. There wasn't anything commercially available that did the phone part for politics well in a decentralized way, where anybody could log on to a platform and get numbers to call and have them connected to the call center capacity that routed them outwards. That had changed over a couple of years. So I think on one level, there was a kind of efficiency that came into the process as the tech world built tools specific for these needs. The other advantage that the O'Rourke campaign had, they had time, and they were hiring field staffers a year out. They knew they didn't have the sort of ambiguities of a primary calendar to deal with. They had time to try and fail at certain types of organizing principles over the course of that year, because they had certainty about what election day was going to be and what they needed to do then that a primary candidate doesn't have. I think the fundamental principles were pretty similar. The thing that ended up being remarkable for the O'Rourke campaign was that they had designed this in part on an expectation that they may have to run some version of a shoestring campaign in a very large and expensive state, and they ended up raising more money than I think, any Senate campaign in history. And so they ended up getting the Cadillac version of a distributed organizing campaign, and they had been, you know, anticipating that if not a Yugo, that they were going to have to be doing the Subaru version of it. By the end of the campaign, they had a massive paid staff in addition to this massive volunteer army. It's just that the roles were really different than what they would have been on a more traditionally hierarchical field campaign.
Was there any discussion when you talked about this sort of stuff with the campaign about critics of that campaign have said, haven't found any fault with that element of it, but they've maybe found fault with his not going negative on Cruz and pointing out earlier the deficits in his opponent?
You need to understand the tactics to sort of get a handle on that big strategic choice that they made, which was to do very little conventional persuasion relative to the size and spending of the campaign. And that's both, I think, as a matter of the volume of it, but especially as you pointed, Nathaniel, the substance, which is there was really no negative on Cruz. There's a little bit of negative advertising. What you call negative advertising was pretty soft given how rich the target is in October. But also broadly, a lot of the advertising, certainly the television advertising that they did, wasn't really designed to persuade voters by even being positive about Beto. I quote in my piece David Weisong, the campaign chief, saying, you know, I just didn't think that there were enough persuadable voters in the middle to win that way. From the beginning, they calculated a path to victory that would work only if they mobilized, you know, their number, which they were public about during the campaign, was 1 million, you know, non-midterm voters. The campaign was lopsided in the direction of anything possible that increases their ability to turn out these 1 million voters, and relatively underweighted what you would do to change the opinions of people who are already likely to vote. And I think when you combine that with Beto's sort of stated high-minded desire not to go negative and not to use pollsters and all the stuff that he said often, you got this campaign that sort of fed on itself, where not only was he not attacking Ted Cruz in sort of personal or policy terms, but he was, you know, moving farther to the left over the course of the campaign than you would think of as optimal positioning to appeal to like median voters. And part of that was that there were, you know, and this is on stuff like being the first Democratic Senate candidate to be open to impeachment, stuff like referring to policing and the criminal justice system as the new Jim Crow, a number of things where once he was in a general election, he was sort of staking out positions farther to the left than he had to, or than he had before in his career. And part of that was that the rewards in terms of volunteer energy and fundraising seemed greater than the costs to his standing, because they had kind of conceded it. The campaign wasn't really about changing people's opinions.
It seems like a kind of a fashionable way of thinking right now on the left about campaigns. There's a lot of people feeling like the battle's been fought for the middle for a long time, at that in general hasn't worked that well, and that mobilizing the unmobilized is the way to go. What's your view on that?
I mean, I think it is fashionable. I think we should take into account that the sort of historical arc that gets us here, which is, yes, in the 80s and 90s, campaigns were treated as an exercise in winning over the middle. There were also, by any objective measure, far more voters, certainly in national elections, who were ticket splitters or party switchers. There were more votes up for grabs in the middle. 2016 might be a bit of an anomaly, but you look in the previous presidential elections, there's just not a lot of fluidity in the middle. One of the things that stands Texas apart is it has particularly low voter engagement numbers. You know, turnout in Texas is almost 20 points lower, just as a baseline, than Wisconsin or Iowa, 25 points lower than Minnesota. That there is something about the Beto case that should be seen as a solution to a uniquely Texas problem, or a problem that's on a unique scale in Texas, which is there's clearly a lot more room for upside mobilizing voters there than there would be in other states. You know, so the way that Stacey Abrams talked about her campaign in some part in Georgia, certainly the way she talked about it, not entirely the way she ran once she won the primary, but it's fashionable. It's also appealing because I think if you're a candidate or advisor to the candidate, it seems to free you from making trade-offs between, you know, satisfying your base and playing to the middle. The idea is if part of what used to motivate the playing to the middle wasn't just that there were voters there, but the idea that that's where there was money for fundraising and that's where certain elite voices were that mattered. If your theory of the case is that media has become more partisan, newspaper editorial boards are less important than they were a generation ago, and that you could raise money in small increments from online from your most devoted supporters, then, you know, maybe there's not a lot to play for in the middle. And you can claim that you're pure and true and authentic. And I think that's an incredibly appealing proposition for candidates. The other big historical factor we're taking into consideration is that the two-party coalitions have cleaved in a way that, mostly because old white people have become more and more Republican, at least on a national basis, that you get this big gap between a party that's anchored in older married white voters who vote at the highest rates and disproportionately younger unmarried people of color in the Democratic Party who vote at the lowest rates. And so, in a way that wasn't true a generation ago when the Democratic Party included a major cohort of sort of New Deal seniors, you can look at it and think that there are far more gains for Democrats to find by sort of playing a mobilization strategy than there would be for Republicans. And it's possible you could end up with intelligently asymmetric campaigns for that reason.
Different model of politics and campaigning in a different time.
Yeah. To double back, you know, and this all happened at a time when we have much better tools for GOTV. We have this sort of body of experimental evidence that points to what works and what doesn't that wasn't available 20 years ago to campaigns. And you have all of this data and ability to individually target GOTV messages. So you don't have to blind knock a whole precinct the way that you would have 20 years ago. And so I think that the strategic objectives and the nature of the coalitions are aligning with these new tools and improved tactics. And it's not hard to see why if you are a Democrat figuring out how you're going to run in a given state, that this looks like a very sensible path.
Just to kind of apply this thinking a bit to the 2020 primaries on the Democratic side, a lot of candidates in a lot of different places running a lot of different models of campaigning in the sense that we've been using it. How do you see that playing out? You know, you got the Sanders already mobilizing that same volunteer base that he had cultivated. Maybe Beto getting in with a variant on that model and everybody else having learned different things along the way.
I mean, I think one of the challenges for just a sort of mobilization strategy in a primary, and let's put aside the sort of distributed organizing tactics for a second, because they're secondary to this. A mobilization strategy works really well if the electorate's already polarized and you can make early inferences from fairly limited information about how people are going to vote months from now and build an organization designed to be in a position to mobilize them at the right time. This is one of the assumptions that Beto brought to his race. Opinions on Ted Cruz were fairly hardened. The party coalitions were polarized. And so you could build a structure that said, hey, you know, we can get a pretty good idea of how millions of people will vote. Now all we have to do is turn them out. That's not how primaries work. Primaries don't polarize neatly.
They might polarize Bernie pro and anti.
Yes, I think that may be right. But in a 16-person field, it's possible that Bernie ends up with a hardened coalition that is incredibly stable and can go from there just trying to turn out his coalition. There may be in small, narrow ways, places where, you know, if Julian Castro is the only Latino candidate in the race and manages to consolidate Latino support
that maybe that's a basis on which to run a mobilization campaign in places where there's density among Latinos. But by and large, I assume we're in for what we've seen, maybe something like the 2012 Republican primary field where candidates rise and fall in a major field. And I don't think it's going to take a lot for an individual voter to switch from liking Warren to being interested in Klobuchar to taking a look at Booker to settling down with Kamala. And it's going to be very difficult to sort of model what a Klobuchar supporter looks like on a given day. Because my guess is a month later, a Klobuchar supporter will look like a relatively different person. If you're building a turnout operation on October 1st based on your profile of who Klobuchar voters are on November 1st or December 1st, or certainly by the time people start voting or caucusing, they're going to be very different, and they're going to be in different places. And so there's a, in certain ways, I think the distributed system works well for that, in that heavy, hard investments in offices and in geographically grounded field staff give way to a more flexible architecture. But I do think anybody who's sort of banking on a GOTV strategy, and maybe as you point out, with the exception of Bernie, is going to have a real trouble just keeping enough stability in their coalition to make that work. And so, you know, I think by and large, I think that, you know, the vogue for thinking of turnout as the solution to problems makes sense in some general election environments. This seems like a very poor bit of turf on which to make that bet.
I talked to a lot of people about political entrepreneurship on this podcast. A lot of people, you've both chatted to many of these folks that are running enterprises in the space, but also you had your own startup, Votecaster, and I was curious just about your experience there and what you learned.
So Votecaster is defunct now, but we started in 2014 trying to develop a forecasting on election day based on real-time turnout data collection. Part of this was inspired by what I knew from reporting about what campaigns did internally, which is they have people who are at polling places, judges of elections, other volunteers, poll watchers, who are in a position to call in at regular intervals a number of people who voted. If campaigns have data about how they expect those precincts to go, you can, over the course of a day, come up with some, you know, rough but directionally useful estimates about how high or low turnout is and who stands to benefit from that. And so with partners, I tried to build out a company on the idea of what happened if you tried to create this system for the publics. And we ended up for the first time getting in the field on Election Day 2016. We were in 8 or 9 states. I can't quite recall. We had a number of media partnerships. That's the bulk of what I worked on. We were in partnership with Vice that did a live stream all day. We had a partnership with Slate that was running data visualizations based on our data. We had some problems, some like simple logistical things, like it was really hard to recruit people who would drive from polling place to polling place in like northern Wisconsin, I remember. And so we had some incredible unevenness in our ability to staff up the way we needed to. I remember dealing with one of our data collectors, I think it was Pompano Beach, Florida, who like got arrested or threatened with arrest by the cops because they said they couldn't go in the polling place, which Florida has very restrictive laws, right? Who can go into polling places? So there were logistical things. And then there were, you know, there were some states where by the end of the day, we were pretty close to where things ended up with the vote count. And there are some places where we were way off. And some of that, I think, has to do with the same types of survey error that that affected a lot of different polling during 2016. Our hope had always been that we would find a lower profile single state election in which to do this as a trial run, as a proof of concept, and work out some of these logistical hurdles. You know, we had problems with our code that we didn't figure out until the morning of Election Day. It was just, it's sort of impossible to do a run through of something like this. And, you know, we'd hope that we'd find a special election with the governor's race that we could do it. And it just never worked to get the financing in place to be able to do that earlier. I think that this is a broader challenge for certain types of political technology. I saw this in reporting the Beto O'Rourke piece. You know, they repeatedly had software fail on them, including they were using a canvassing app called Polis, which they chose because it sort of lent itself to the distributed organizing model better than some other canvassing apps with initials in them that are used by other Democratic campaigns. But one of the problems that they discovered was that they were the biggest campaign ever to use Polis, and it went down. I was there on a Sunday, the only Sunday of early vote, on a day when they had tens of thousands of volunteer shifts scheduled. In the middle of the afternoon, it went down, and the leadership of the field team spent the afternoon on the phone with the CEO of the company trying to figure out what was wrong with the software, because it had never been tested in the field at that level of intensity. And I think it's a huge challenge for lots of types of political technology. I mean, the scale and intensity of a presidential election day, or even a big statewide, is unlike a lot of things that exist in consumer marketing or advertising or consumer tech. And it is very hard to replicate some of that in a sort of laboratory setting in advance.
It's very hard to plan for the spike. And that's kind of what sorted out some of the competitors in the early 2000s, and which ones were able to handle that and which ones weren't. Sasha, it's been great to talk to you today. Is there a question I should have asked that I failed to?
You could ask me what I'm doing now.
What are you doing now?
Yeah. I'm finishing a book that I've been working on for, almost 7 years now. So I've been writing a history of the battles over gay marriage, a political and legal history of the sort of whole arc of the marriage debate in the United States. So
that sounds like a really good topic. What attracted you to that topic?
So I was working on the Victory Lab in 2011. I remember at a number of points that year, I was interviewing a lot of pollsters or people who studied opinion in some form or another. And people would repeatedly invoke the movement that had taken place in opinions on gay marriage in the service of making some other point. And often I just would sort of ask people, like, so what do you think happened there? And nobody really had a good fingertip explanation for it. And I came to realize that summer is when I finally saw, when the New York State Senate voted to pass the marriage bill and Cuomo signed it, that was the first time I thought, okay, I see how this is going to end. I thought it would take far longer, with far more friction, frankly, than it has. But I sort of saw the end of this thing in sight. And I came to realize that, you know, I've been alive for the whole life of this thing as an issue. I've covered politics through most of it. And I have no idea how we got from wherever there was to wherever here is. And that we didn't have a kind of common public line. People wanted to say this is the civil rights movement of our generation, but there wasn't the sort of common vocabulary. I didn't know who the Rosa Parks of this civil rights movement was, or what the Haymarket riots of this was, or who the top suffragettes were. They're just, people wanted to sort of see it in this canon of civil rights movements. And there just wasn't a familiar idea of what the arc of this story was. And, you know, starting in high school, had sort of devoured a lot of the big books that journalists had started to write in the late 70s about the civil rights movement. The sort of first works of history on the civil rights movement were mostly written by journalists. And I came to realize that we were getting to the point where you could bring that type of perspective and tools to bear on this marriage conflict. And so I, as soon as Obama came out in favor in the spring of 2012, I set out to work on a book, and it's taken me a lot longer than I expected, because events have happened more quickly than I expected. But it should come out next year, and I'm dealing with edits at the moment. And I think it sort of helps to encapsulate an era between sort of the end of the Cold War and between the start of this very Trumpy identity nationalism, where issues of sexual politics were, you know, the most divisive, certainly domestic social issues in the country. And so a lot of it gets told through the story of Americans fighting over the definition of marriage.
Sounds fascinating. What's it going to be called?
This is subject to change once the publicity and marketing people get their claws into it. But The Engagement, A Quarter Century of Defending, Defining, and Expanding Marriage in America. It will be published by Knopf.
Awesome. Well, it's Wonderful to talk to you today. Anything else you want to say?
No, enjoyed it. Thank you, Nathaniel.
Thank you.
That was Sasha Eisenberg. He's at Sasha Eisenberg, ISSENberg.com. I look forward to reading Sasha's work for years to come. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.